down well. If you leave me all alone, I'll make a mess for sure. I've a heart of gold in the smallest size. Leave me in the dark, you'll never hear me cry. More than an illustration, points of articulation come to life on a brass spring. Such a wonderful plaything.
Hair Raising by Atlan Merrick. Read by Laura McEwen. A Sherlock / fic. Rating is explicit. Pairing is Sherlock and John. Additional tags. Remote control sex. Sort of. Reader's note. I don't typically read the chapter summaries from AO3, but Atlan Merrick's were so hysterical and so specific to the story that I had to include them. They are separated from the chapter by a short musical bit. Summary. What do John and Sherlock do when medication's side effects leave Sherlock with extremely sensitive follicles and a desire to experiment? What do you think they do? Have a sort of remote control sex, of course. Chapter 1. Don't touch him! Sherlock ducked down the alley until he was in a pool of streetlight and started rifling through his wallet. Are you listening, Sherlock? Seconds later, he spun around and grabbed John's arse. Stop it! John clapped both hands over his own bum. What are you doing? Sherlock shoved his hands below John's hands and clutched. Wallet, John! Wallet! John Hamish Watson Holmes stood to his full, stroppy height, which had the interesting and immediate effect of causing Sherlock to reduce his own. A bribe! Sherlock hissed. I need money for a bribe! The good doctor stepped back, nodded curtly. There, was that so hard? Words, just a few, Sherlock, that's all I ask. Now if— Hey! Finished with contrition, Sherlock again groped his husband's behind, looking for— There! Sherlock yanked John's wallet free, tugged out a few bills. £20 will be enough. I'll give it back when we get home. John laughed at the idea of Sherlock replacing anything at all, ever. The cap on the toothpaste, £20. The sword in the stone, if he'd happened on that. Listen, I want you to— Sherlock was already heading down the alley, but not so fast that John, teeth gritted, strop right back on, couldn't dart out a hand and snatch at the swirl of a coat hem. Gah! The great detective tripped, spun, scowled, hissed. John Watson Holmes, if we lose this lead— A small man again deployed every inch of his smallness to shut a tall man right the hell up. Don't touch him. Do you hear me? Sherlock huffed an acknowledgement that he heard. Then, pointedly glaring at John's pinch-fingered grip, he spun around and took off down the alley. If John was going to hang on to that hem, he was going to be moving at speed very shortly. But it was good. It was all good. By the time Sherlock got to the end of his coat and the alley, John had let go and returned to the shadows, tossing his husband a double thumbs up as the lanky git dashed across Victoria Embankment and toward the shadows of Waterloo Bridge for his assignation with the informant. And while he skirted traffic, flaring that damn coat so he looked bigger, much like a kitten will puff up to appear more powerful, the good doctor nodded to himself and knew, he absolutely knew with 100% certainty, that Sherlock was going to let the informant touch him. It's not like I didn't tell you. Shut up, John. John could shut up. However, John was not going to shut up. Are you a doctor, Sherlock? Sat forlorn in the middle of the tub, an aggrieved consulting detective tugged his bare legs to his naked chest, wrapped an unclothed arm around the lot, then dug the nails of the other hand into his scalp. "I'll take that as a no." John smacked Sherlock's hand out of his curls. "You may be a super genius, and you may know exactly what to say to a larcenous stockbroker 5 weeks on the run and living under an abutment, and everyone at the Met may have given you a nod of approval on the speed with which you closed the case." As his husband pontificated, Sherlock's other hand crept into his hair, and he got a good bloody scratch going before John pinched him. "Ouch! But not one of you is a doctor. None of you are me. Now," John snapped on a pair of rubber gloves, took a battle stance, though on his knees tubside, "will you listen next time I tell you not to touch someone?" Sherlock was about to answer that purely rhetorical question when Dr. Watson leaned forward and mashed a handful of creamy goo into Sherlock's hair. "That burns!" Even his long arms flailed. Even as 12.5 stone of naked outrage writhed beneath him, John Watson rubbed treacly, eye-stinging medication into his husband's inky locks. "I told you not to touch him," the good doctor said, in purely conversational tones. "You're killing me!" The knuckles of one wildly waving hand thumped John's head. A pointed elbow clipped him in the shoulder, but it wasn't until Sherlock knocked himself half-unconscious with a hard knee to his own temple that John got some well-deserved cooperation. "I never tell you how to deduce, what bribes to pay, the sort of statement to give at the Met."
"Yes, you do!"
"I let you do your job, and all I ask is the common courtesy that you let me do mine."
"I can't breathe!"
"If you just do that, we wouldn't have to do this." Sherlock went fetal, slamming forehead to knees and arms around legs, and he might have made huge, huge sounds of aggrievement, but John was still on a roll. "And by that I mean, if you just listen to my professional opinion when I tell you not to touch a man who has been living under a bridge for 5 weeks, then..."
"I didn't touch him!" Sherlock yelled in the vicinity of his solar plexus.
John rolled his eyes. "Head lice don't care who makes the first dance move, Sherlock. You touch him, he touches you. Same difference to the head lice tango. All these bloody buggers care about is that one head gets near another and..."
"Blah, blah, blah!"
shouted Sherlock in the general direction of his itchy groin. "Stand up, you shouty big baby." Sherlock took a shaky, shuddery breath and whined,
"I am not a big baby."
"Get your hand off your crotch." Sherlock continued to scratch his privates.
"It itches."
"You can't get head lice in pubic hair." Sherlock would beg to differ, but he was entirely too disgruntled to give John the satisfaction of an argument. He just continued to maul his crotch with one hand and his head with the other. "If you get that goo in your eyes, you'll go instantly blind, so get your hands off your person, put the shower on, rinse out the treatment." Sherlock was pretty sure John was lying about the blindness, but just in case, he stopped scratching long enough to turn on the shower, and it would be very true to say he was not even a little bit sorry the spray caught John in the eye.
"I'm sorry, John!"
John was too busy swearing to reply. "Do you feel better?" Curled onto the sofa, back to the room, bare naked spine radiating indignation, petulance, and also a desire for curry, Sherlock did not answer. "I have no idea why you're angry at me. I didn't give you head lice. I tried to prevent you from getting head lice. So why this is my fault, I really can't imagine. Yellow, green, or red?" Sherlock lay very still, busy marshalling a foolproof argument as to why all this was John's fault. "Yellow, please." As John went to call in their curry order, Sherlock brought to bear all of his considerable genius on figuring out how John could be blamed for the fact that his head felt funny.
his crotch still itched. And maybe he was having trouble seeing out of his left eye. After a good and solid 3 minutes of super-geniusing, enough time for John to call in the order, turn on the telly, find something inane to watch, and also start scratching his own head, Sherlock hit the nail on the head. Words! John ignored the bellow from the belly of the sofa, and said conversationally, I got some naan, and papadums too. I know how you like foods that shatter. Ha! Now that Sherlock knew he had the entire upper hand, he would not be diverted so easily, though he does quite like when comestibles surrender dramatically, and has been known to eat an entire half kilo of cinder toffee for the sheer joy of its brittle break between the teeth. Still fetal curled on the sofa, nude, of course, because he felt it was more dramatic that way, Sherlock shouted again, Words, John Watson! John pondered. The food would be delivered in about 25 minutes. There was just rubbish on the telly, and John was bored. With a shrug, the good doctor figured he might as well engage his toddler for the next little bit, being as there was just nothing much else to do. Yes, words, they are the simple, simple things I ask of you when you didn't give me enough of them. John pondered some more. If they were going to converse like civilized barbarians, the yelling would have to stop. The yelling has to stop, John said conversationally, and then he added, somehow already knowing this discussion was not going to turn out as planned, Explain. Sherlock's curved spine straightened, his pert bum perted, and John could feel the vulpine grin on Sherlock's face before he saw it. The good detective rose to a seated position and said in purely conversational tones, You didn't give me enough words, Watson, so this is all your fault.
What now?
And let me tell you why. Author's note, I've never had Sherlock call John by his surname. Writing that sentence scandalized me completely. This story was inspired by the without-peer Chocolat Mousse, who requested I expand on an entry in Minutiae 38, said entry inspired by Benedict, saying he has extremely sensitive hair follicles. P.S. And yet, once again, a surely this will be a brief one-chapter fic turns into crack-ode of so far three chapters. End author's note.
It's a cruel cross that I have to bear. If you come a little close, I'm going to pull your hair. More than just a toy in a patched blue suit. Hold me in your arms, I'm just a boy like you.
Hair-raising. Chapter 2. Chapter Summary. John was caught between a spidery grip and a hard place. Admit he had a strong suspicion as to what was going on, and he'd also admit he was the one who'd caused it to go. Admit nothing, and, well, there really was no downside there. Unless... My fault? My fault. I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about, said Watson, who completely knew what Sherlock was talking about. Wet curls mashed this way and that. Sherlock rose from the sofa like some sort of land-bound water god. The look was fetching. You look fetching, John said, employing a Sherlock-quality diversion. It fell on damp, semi-deaf ears.
You spend an inordinate amount of time trying to brainwash me with your manners and your morals. I let you do this because it makes you happy.
John opened his mouth to say something rude. Sherlock looked briefly reflective, said softly,
And because it makes me a better person.
Everyone absorbed this, then moved on. However, it goes both ways, Dr. Watson. You must give if you get. They were not discussing anything remotely pornographic, of which John was currently aware. But Sherlock's emphasis on those G-words was both orally striking and stirring. However, Dr. Watson pushed those thoughts aside. They had 20 minutes until the curry was delivered, more than enough time to bicker this on through to conclusion, not nearly enough time for a quality rut. And the boys of Baker Street nearly always favor high-caliber coupling
over any other kind. But that was neither here nor there. What was here was John, and John went and pretty much almost ruined everything. He apologized. You're right, Sherlock, and I'm wrong. In 2 years as lovers and then one as husbands, John has said those words, in that order, exactly, never. Wait, that's not precisely true. He's apologized, he's admitted misunderstandings, misinformation, mistakes, but rarely right away. Usually it's after 800 weeks of squabbling, then 300 days of qualified admissions. Because John and Sherlock, they bicker. They've done it from the day they met. They will do it until the moment they shuffle off their mortal coil. It is, was, and ever shall be one of the many, many ways they say, I love you, be mine. Which is why John expressing his regrets so early in the game was not sporting. The good doctor realized his error immediately. To cover his faux pas, he argued about his lack of argument. It's not like you'd listen, now is it? Because I could talk until I was blue, and I'm sure you just swan around selectively deaf until I got to the words brilliant or darling. Sherlock swanned around the sitting room, waiting for John to stop talking. When at last he did, Sherlock completely ignored the entire last 2 minutes and said self-righteously, "So what should you have done under that bridge that you emphatically did not do, Mr. Watson?" Watson, Mr. Watson, Dr. Watson. This was new. John liked it. He wasn't sure why. It, however, emphatically did not matter. What mattered was that Sherlock was now standing in front of a sitting-room window, and approximately 1,000 times John has asked him to refrain from doing so naked. Those words, however, are some of the many to which Sherlock is selectively deaf. But that was fine, which was really rather fine. Because standing in front of that window, pontificating, Sherlock was also posing. John wasn't sure if it was intentional, but, like the whole Watson thing, that absolutely didn't matter. "I'll tell you what you should have done," said the unclad detective, hand on hip, hip thrust to the side so that one butt cheek loomed, more saucy and plump than the other. "You should have said to me, 'Sherlock Holmes, genius detective, dashing man that I love.'" At this point, Sherlock paused to draw himself up and puff out his chest in a dashing manner. The marvellous side effect was that his arse stuck out even further, half-filling the sitting room with its ample swell. "I suggest that you stay away from the stockbroker under the bridge, the one you located with nothing more than a hair sample and a half cup of tepid tea, and here is my itemized list as to why." Sherlock may or may not have lifted his chin and licked his lips in a very Watson-esque way, gearing up, no doubt, to hold forth in a fashion he deemed very Watson-esque. But he, at that moment, pushed a half-dry curl out of his eye and back amongst its brethren. And all the Watson words jammed up in his throat dissolved into the thinnest of air, except two. Oh, shit. Watson himself was brought up short by the spontaneous swearing, but just as he was about to say something, Sherlock did something, and that something was to remove his hand from his head and let the other hand near his head, essentially hovering both hands in the air as if he were about to lay hands upon his own self in Watson-esque frustration. But he did not do that. Instead, he turned from the sitting-room window, much to the chagrin of the third-floor neighbor across the street, those long-fingered hands still suspended on either side of his big-brained head, and Sherlock looked at John as if John knew exactly what was going on and would tell him how to proceed. John knew what was going on. Something. Because something is always going on at 221B, and usually it's something Sherlock started, is in the middle of, forgot to finish, or for which he can be blamed. Yet this something, John sensed, was something that was maybe, just maybe, his fault. Slowly, silently, as if making a foray across enemy lines, John rose and crept toward Sherlock, tread so stealthy even creaky floorboards did not creak. When at last he stood before his husband, who looked down at him wide-eyed, hands still hovering either side of his dewy locks, John whispered, as if passing along intel about troop movements, "Something happened." This profundity was met with a frantic nod. John leaned confidentially close, whispered, "What?" The detective had been expecting the doctor to tell him, but in lieu of that, Sherlock just bowed his head. A few heartbeats later, each coming more quickly than the last, John sent out a questing finger and tentatively touched one dark ringlet. Nothing happened. John thought about reclaiming his hand and saying something like, "Yes, well, Curry should be here shortly. Let's try the telly again." But John's a braver man than that, and so John did what any straight-backed soldier would do. Sent out reinforcements in the form of a second finger. Side by side, as if for moral support, fingers one and two moved tentatively toward those moist locks, and a ringlet was carefully touched. Nothing happened. It was then that John thought to himself, "Well, there you go. Who knows what he's on about this time? Let's just call the curry place back, because really, that food should have been here by now." As if sensing these thoughts, Sherlock did the one thing he could have done that would cause John to do the thing he did. Sherlock bowed his head lower still. And so John, who cannot ever resist a compliant Sherlock, sent forth half a battalion in the form of an entire hand, and tentatively he brushed five fingertips across Sherlock's scalp. At first John had no clue what happened, because it happened so quickly, and what happened was that Sherlock fell to his knees, as in rattle the floor with a mighty thud of it, fell. But before John could look down and say, "What the hell just happened?" Sherlock looked up, hands still hovering beside his head, and said, "What just happened?" In reply, John a little bit stepped back to make room for his innocence. Because if anyone in this room was sure of anything at all, it was John Watson, who was absolutely certain that this was completely his fault. John tried stepping back again, but Sherlock finally remembered what hands are for and took hold of one of his husband's fingers. He didn't do anything with it, but the clutching did mean John could no longer proclaim his blamelessness with retreat. John. The man so named was caught between a spidery grip and a hard place. Admit he had a strong suspicion as to what was going on, and he'd also admit he was the one who had caused it to go. Admit nothing, and, well, there really was no downside there, and John was about to possibly do that when Sherlock blinked up at him with big, trusting eyes. You might or might not be having a reaction to the lice shampoo, and as a matter of fact, the label recommends applying it to a small patch of skin on the inside of your elbow to test for allergic response, but I forgot to do that part. Does it feel very terrible? Is it burning? Oh God, Sherlock, I'm so sorry. John. This happens. This always happens. Sherlock goes nearly non-verbal in times of stress, capable of uttering one syllable and one only, and that one is a name, and that name is John. Usually when this happens, John has the words for Sherlock. He'll go on and on when it's necessary that he go on and on, and usually that's easy to do because Sherlock started something crazy, is in the middle of something crazy, or the crazy is on fire, and so John can rant with verve. But not now. Now John found himself in an uncommon place. He was the one to blame, and so all John could do was this.
I'm so sorry, Sherlock. It was unfamiliar ground, this being the one in the right, and so Sherlock could be forgiven for mounting a high horse just now and riding hard, so to speak, but that was not what the good detective did. There, on his knees, in front of a very contrite doctor, and a third-floor neighbour who'd gone and fetched her binoculars, and her best friend, what Sherlock did was say something completely unexpected.
John, pull my hair.
Author's note. Benedict says sensitive follicles, and a year later I sit here breathing funny. The world is a strange and beautiful place. More to come, until they come, of course. End author's note.
But your mama thought there was something wrong. Didn't want you sleeping with a boy too long. It's a serious thing in a grown-up world. Maybe you'd be better with a Barbie girl.
Hair Raising, Chapter 3. Chapter Summary. Sherlock looked John in the eye, clutched a fistful of his own fringe, and yanked. His entire chest bloomed with goose flesh. Every sparse hair round his nipples stood on end, and Sherlock's cock jerked up, a turgid little marionette on invisible strings.
Oh, pull my hair.
That was what Sherlock said. No, no, that's not what Sherlock said. That was what Sherlock had begged. Because being on one's knees, eyes soulful wide, a soft and tremulous lilt to the voice, these are the precise components required to qualify a thing as begging. And John's response to that begging was not his usual one. In days gone by, yesterday, for example, the good doctor's response to Sherlock's entreaties, "Please let me put it in your, John," is usually to open wider, suck harder, or put more sugar on it. Not today. In response to Sherlock's pleading this time, John did exactly nothing. John had been expecting a high horse, an entire herd of them. So, completely sure he'd heard wrong, the good doctor grunted, "What now?" Sherlock's quite used to begging, wheedling, and supplicating to get what he wants. John's not his tiny tyrant for nothing. Some might say Sherlock even likes all the imploring, but Sherlock would call them idiots who clearly don't know a damn thing about the straight-backed Sherlock begs no man homes. "Please," Sherlock gently tugged John's index finger again, whispered, "please, will you pull my hair?" Here's the thing. Sherlock sometimes likes a certain sort of pain, and sometimes John likes giving it to him. Sometimes, however, was not this time, for it is difficult to feel sexy when you feel guilty. Sherlock, on his knees, mouth open like a guileless little bird, John's finger clutched tight in one fist. Sherlock awaited the illuminating particulars of John's plan of attack. Because when John starts something, and this was emphatically something John had started, he always finishes it. Sherlock, however, right now it seemed John was having difficulty finishing a sentence. John Watson was short of words. Fortunately, unless he's under duress, Sherlock usually has entirely more than his fair share, and so, in a giving vein, the good detective offered a few.
"You could pull here," Sherlock gestured, using John's hand, "or stroke there," again with the John gesticulation. "Perhaps you could push here and..." Because this was beginning to sound disturbingly like that time Sherlock talked his husband into frotting with him at Downing Street during a power outage, John at last found his voice. "Sherlock, I can't." Sherlock released John's finger. Somehow this seemed the worst possible response, and so John opened his fine mouth, and he damn well babbled.
"I'd love to do all of those things, but I think that this is possibly a bit no good. I think you're having an allergic reaction, and maybe we should just lie down or wash your hair again, or maybe we should take you to the doc."
Sherlock looked John in the eye, clutched a fistful of his own fringe, and yanked. His entire chest bloomed with goose flesh. Every sparse hair round his nipples stood on end, and Sherlock's cock jerked up, a turgid little marionette on invisible strings.
"Tur!"
After a few long seconds for everyone to absorb everything, Sherlock unclutched. All of his parts resumed their resting state, while John's parts, particularly his heart, now thrummed like a motherfucker. After long seconds, Sherlock again took hold of his husband's index finger. Then Sherlock bowed his head and, with the sweet patience of a man who knows he'll get what he wants if he is sweetly patient, Sherlock waited. The neighbor across the street clutched a friend so hard there were marks later. John opened his mouth to reply. There was a knock on the ground floor door. The curry had arrived. John Watson looked at Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes did not look up at John Watson. And that's what decided everything. Because here's another thing. Sherlock likes a good curry. People think he doesn't much care for food, but they're wrong. Sherlock does not much care for boredom. The tube is boring. Wordy courtesy is boring. Beans on toast are boring. That's why if Sherlock needs to move, he'll stride. If he's going to talk, he'll fill a quiet room with the scattershot of his words. And if he's going to eat, he will damn well stuff himself stupid on the things he loves. And one of those things is definitely yellow curry. So spicy hot, his brow goes dewy, and he gets hiccups that can only be quickly cured by licorice all sorts or John's ejaculate, depending on which is most available and not laughing its arse off. And here's another thing. The early days of their relationship are long gone and good riddance, and by that John means so long to the days when Sherlock slept poorly, ate poorly, behaved poorly, didn't know that being better each would make him better at everything. But mostly good riddance to the days when Sherlock would avoid eating so stupidly. Often he'd end up with belly cramps or bruises on skin too starved to well heal. Yes, good riddance to bad habits is what John says, and for the last 3 years John's made sure they stay rid of them by rarely waking a sleeping Sherlock, by hardly ever correcting a courtesy even if it's wildly misplaced, complimenting a mourner on her hair at her husband's funeral, and especially, most very especially, John will never stop Sherlock from eating, not ever, well, unless it's a third bag of all sorts, again. Proving this last point to better fill Sherlock up, John has put more edible substances on his body in more places, some very tender and inclined toward rash, than he can count. Proving this last point further, John's put sugar in meals in which sugar should not be, poured Sherlock teas and made him lattes, buttered toast and made eggs. He's fed and fed and fed his lover by his own hand, and will do so until the day he's dead and beyond if he can manage that.
so you will understand. For John to hear that knock downstairs, and to know that there was piping hot curry a couple dozen meters distant, and to wait for Sherlock to respond and then watch him not do so, was a pretty big deal. In the end, it didn't matter. The best friend of the neighbor across the street caught up with the delivery guy as he was leaving. She paid for the naan, the papadum, and all the rest, then scooted right on back to her friend's flat. And John Watson looked at the bowed head of Sherlock Holmes and had himself a think. The reason this think did not include thinking about a trip to A&E is simple. Shit happens. At 221B, so much shit happens so often in such bizarre ways that if they went to hospital every time anything remotely shit-like occurred, neither would have a chance to eat yellow curry or solve crimes. So over the years, they've ended up creating what John calls the system. The system is the very essence of simplicity. If a body part is not bleeding, swelling, or on fire, there is time to have a think and a cup of tea. Over tea, the following questions are answered. Does it hurt? If the answer is yes, they decamp to A&E. The answer is no, the next question is, are you lying? If the answer is yes, A&E. If the answer is no, there are generally no further questions, and everyone finishes their tea and moves on with their life. Without asking, John knew that Sherlock was not bleeding, he was not on fire, and the only one perhaps swelling was John, as Sherlock remained so quietly on his knees, chin to chest. That just left one bit of the system to work through. Does it hurt, Sherlock? Sherlock shook his head. Are you sure? Sherlock nodded his surety. Do you want it to? When John was 11, there were things he could not have imagined doing. Liking girls, liking boys, killing, healing, hurting his one true love. But John's into his 40s now, and he's done all of them and more besides. And that last bit, the hurting part, he does that a lot. Because John's one true love is all nerve endings. Sherlock sees so much, thinks so much about what he sees, that oftentimes it's as if the man's nothing more than axon and dendrite and pulse, exquisitely tuned to do one thing. Receive. John learned early in their relationship that one way to help Sherlock manage all that input was to give him more. And one of the easiest ways to do that, hurt him. Another thing John was surprised to learn, he likes to do that. At last, Sherlock looked up. It's been years since they first got together. On Sherlock's face just now was an expression from those early days, a wide-eyed one, eloquent with curiosity, with a desire to try it and see. So certain was John of Sherlock's answer that he was already breathing deeper, muscles loose, heart pounding, ready, not ready, to do things that were a bit not good. Then the good detective went and surprised him. John, Sherlock said, wriggling his husband's index finger, will you make love to my hair? Author's note. I know this chapter took 100 years to appear. I also know that it's all talk, talk, talk. Sometimes that's part of the foreplay. Yes, indeed. Sometimes it very much is. End author's note. Raising. Chapter 4. Chapter Summary. Head lice ought not to inspire romance. Try telling that to John Watson and Sherlock Holmes. But afterward, only afterward, after there, then. Sherlock is precise. Now, for example, means please do not take another step, John. Please get inside this cupboard, John. Please let's... Oh, God, yes. Harder, for another example, means pound with such vigor my head hits the headboard, John. Go so deep that I... Oh! And make love? For Sherlock Holmes, it means murmur to me, John. Touch me gently, John. Dance your fingers over my ears and mouth, along my belly and thigh. It means love me slowly, tenderly, for as long as you want me, for as long as you can. And of all the many things John is good at, Sherlock knows making love is perhaps one of John's greatest skills. And at the very heart of his grace is this. In most things, John is meticulous, and so John is slow. In a moment, for example, means go ahead without me. Just go. No, really, Sherlock, I'm not moving from this spot until I'm satisfied with what, where, who, and why. I'll be along shortly, for another example, means I don't get it. However, I'm going to get it, and you can just fly off the handle somewhere else, mister. I've got important John shit to do, and I'm taking my time. And making love? Oh, that's what slow is for. For John Watson, that slowness is born of a cell-deep need to give, maybe heal, with something as vital, small, and earth-shattering as his gentle touch. Touch, John said, surprised the moment the word came from his mouth. Touch yourself and show me. Sherlock blinked up at John. For long seconds he thought, and then Sherlock Holmes let go of his husband's index finger, sat back on his heels, and began to make love to himself. Before John, Sherlock rarely touched his own body. He was not a sensual man, for Sherlock there were few pleasures of the flesh. And then came John, in all the ways John could come. First, he magicked himself up in a lab, coming inside from an overcool day, standing straight by the lab door, forgetting wounds, both literal and spiritual, as he watched a consulting detective dance. Then John came in other ways, amazing ways. John came because Sherlock touched him, and so Sherlock could not stop touching him. And John touched back. And suddenly Sherlock understood metaphor, because the stroke of John's fingers across his belly felt like fire. John's hand around his cock set off a klaxon in his head. He goddamn wanted to sing. Then what was good got even better. John asked him to touch himself. And in one night, in one hour, Sherlock learned how much getting you get when you give. Years on from that long ago night, a night where he had made love to John by making love to himself, Sherlock knelt naked on a dusty rug in a dusk-dark room, his scalp tingling and oversensitive, and he set about the sweet, sweet business of getting by giving. His first touch was delicate. The fingers of both hands trailed through the hair behind the curves of his ears, skittering goosebumps from neck to nipple. John's tongue, tempted by the sight, slicked across his lips. His second touch was light. Two index fingers wriggled deep into the curls, stroked scalp, and goose flesh washed from nipple to navel. John giggled. His third touch was for John. Sherlock pushed long fingers through his hair, gripped, tugged hard, and like fireworks his body blazed, goosebumps everywhere, arms and legs, belly and balls. He arched as if toward his lover, and Sherlock's untouched cock, well, that beauty rose like a marionette on strings, and perhaps that should have been funny, yes, quite funny. Except no one was laughing, not even a little bit, because two someones were moaning. And then one was moving. John went to his knees behind Sherlock, whispering sweet and senseless things as he spread his legs and nested Sherlock's long body between them. "Can I?" he murmured, gentle hands settling on his husband's chest and belly. "Please." Sherlock didn't answer, not with words, because just then Sherlock turned, gaze caught, then held. So John looked too. Oh. Night has a way of creeping up quiet, hushing the frenetic world outside, bringing stillness and turning a simple pane of glass into a dark and pretty mirror. John blinked slowly when he saw them in perfect profile in that long sitting room pane. They were there in soft light, wrapped together, held and holding. Sherlock settled bare between John's thighs and in John's arms. And then there, oh there, as the fingers of the good doctor's hand slid up a belly, a neck, and into curls, Sherlock's body bowed again. Wanting more of that, of all of it, John laid his cheek on Sherlock's shoulder and, watching them in that dark mirror, he did as he'd been bid. He made love to Sherlock's hair. Sliding his palm up along the curve at the back of Sherlock's skull, John buried fingers slow into soft curls. For the longest time he didn't move, just counted Sherlock's heartbeats until they went giddy fast. Then John raked down. Sherlock arched hard, pressing his bum against John's erection. At the feel of that jeans-clad cock against bare skin, Sherlock gripped John's thighs and ground down. And because a feedback loop loops, John pushed fingers into curls again, then went still, stiller, stillest. And when beneath his other palm he could feel Sherlock's breathing stutter, John scratched at scalp. Sherlock groaned, grinding down as if John's clothed cock could penetrate him if he angled his arse just right. Free hand gliding from Sherlock's chest to cheek and then up into Sherlock's hair, John filled both fists with thick, dark curls and with both hands pulled down. With a giggling hum, John watched himself dig in again, snarl 10 fingers into the curly mess, and at every tangled pull, Sherlock's hips rose up as if driving in. At each fisted push, Sherlock bore down as if getting on. Over and over, in a glorious loop they did this, rocking against each other, Sherlock's cock growing heavier, his moans thick, and oh yes, that, John wanted more of that. "Please," John whispered, "make noise." Sherlock stopped rubbing his bare ass against the bulge in John's trousers to laugh dark and deep. Oh, if there's one thing Sherlock Holmes Watson knows how to do, if there's one thing he loves to do, it's make noise. Baby Sherlock was a weeper, a wailer, a gnasher of little milk teeth. He let the world know of his tiny needs the moment those wee needs manifested. Adult Sherlock chatters and yammers and yells. He'll make a racket, rouse a rabble, whatever it takes to get what he wants. Lover Sherlock, well, he's another creature entirely. That's noise, squared with uproar, cubed with glorious pandemonium. Once Sherlock realized all the sounds that wanted to bubble out of him when John touched here, there, anywhere. Once he realized they were welcome. Oh, Sherlock just never shut up. He's like a damned orchestra. Or maybe he's like something else. Or something other than that. All John knows is he actually bought a tattered old thesaurus long ago, pulled out the page containing the word moan, and for a while had it stuck to the fridge. And John studied that scrap of paper. He looked at it every day for a week, because the good doctor wanted to know now and forever all the ways to describe the sounds Sherlock made. He wanted to have something more than simple words. Yet in the end, nothing was better than the elementary. So when Sherlock makes noise, John will tell you Sherlock moans. He groans. He sighs and murmurs and breathes. And he does these things in a dozen times, a dozen ways. And really, actually, the words don't matter. What matters is that Sherlock pleasures John by letting John hear his pleasure. And that's why, when John's spider danced his fingers along the back of Sherlock's neck and up into his hair again, Sherlock opened his mouth, and he moaned so loudly, the neighbor across the street fell off her chair. Her best friend never even noticed. "More," moaned Sherlock. "More," he groaned loud. "More," he shouted. So John gave him more. He tapped fingers along temples and ears. He pinched up one lock of hair, then two. He tugged gently, then hard. He twirled curls around index fingers and pinkies. He pressed palms to the graceful curves at forehead and temple, and with each touch, Sherlock groaned lavish. His big hands locked hard around John's thighs. His head fell back onto John's shoulder. He arched up. And when John clutched two fistfuls of hair and went still, Sherlock did too. Back a bold and beautiful curl. And on that precipice, Sherlock shook. He moaned, breath stuttering, and Sherlock waited. And waited, and damn well waited. Because these two can have ungodly amounts of sexual patience. Not always at the same time, mind. There are days when one is keen to clamber on and get it deep, and the other, oh, he's in the mood for moody canoodling, for syrup dark whispers, slow strokes, the ache of waiting. Far more rarely, they're on the same hurry-hurry page, using speed as foreplay, letting an imminent cab or the sound of Lestrade pausing for a quick cuppa with Mrs. Hudson get them there and back again before they so much as tug trousers past mid-thigh. But here, right here in the half-light, was where John and Sherlock really lived. This was the place of tenterhook and tiptoe. It was where one presents and the other pushes. It was where one pulls and pulls and the other pants and shakes. And it was here, right now. It was John at last turning from his voyeuristic pleasures and looking down the graceful curve of Sherlock's chest and belly to his upthrust hips. That was Sherlock's erection, as lavishly curved as his back. And when John began to move again, tiny tugs of Sherlock's hair, he could see his husband's cock grow thicker, heavier, with each pull. With each pull, Sherlock moaned, as if John's hands were down there, stroking, and with the lip-biting thought of down there, Oh, how those two words go right to John's cock. John kept it up, those quick little pulls, and at this point Sherlock wasn't moaning any more. He was grunting, the tendons in his neck taut, arms trembling, and John knew he was close, and that's when John thought about slowing or stopping again, another delicious detour on the long and breathless journey. But what Sherlock, who could just about taste the teas on John's breath, thought about what was, oh, hell no. Balancing precarious on John's thigh with one hand, Sherlock shot the other up and into John's hair, and he fisted those long fingers into those pale locks, and at the bad good pain, John moaned. And that was it. That was everything. Sherlock started coming in thick, heavy spurts, low on his belly. It took them another 2 hours before they realized they hadn't eaten, and there was a good reason for that. It was because Sherlock, who has a small, hardly noticeable, easy to deny if you pretend you didn't hear your husband mention it fetish for messing around with his own cum, used that very same cum to slick up his hand, while John Watson, there on his knees, tugged his erection out of his trousers. Sherlock then proceeded to stroke-tease his husband for so long that that cum got sticky and not good for jerking at all, and so Sherlock pushed John onto his back and licked a little, then sucked a lot, and then he stopped that so as to clamber onto John and tease him with the crack of his back-end bounty. But you try having Sherlock Holmes grinding his naked arse on your erection for 10 panting minutes and see if you don't feel you've paid your teasing dues. So instead, as Sherlock tried shifting yet again, the better to chatter teeth over John's hip bone and belly and thigh, John grabbed hold of his sweetheart's hair, and Sherlock moaned so loud the neighbor's best friend dropped her binoculars, a heavy pair that actually left a dent in the hardwoods. And then Sherlock long-armed some lube from beneath the coffee table, shoved John's cock right on up his arse, proceeded to ride like a wild man until the good doctor clenched his thighs around detective-y hips and came so well he lost the ability to speak, move, or open his eyes for 5 entire minutes. Then, after a 45-minute catnap on the floor, a hot shower, making and consuming of tea, and drawing the curtains, Sherlock, of course, did it in the nude, bright lights blazing behind him so that he looked like some kind of flaccid archangel. They realized they were absolutely famished. "We should order a curry," said Sherlock, slumped on the sofa and gently fingering his tresses to see if the side effect was still in play. A tepid wash of goosebumps and the bare shiver over a limp penis showed that it was, but markedly less so. "Yellow, I think. What do you say, Dr. Watson?" Dr. Watson put the telly on, but the viewing was simply atrocious, so he turned it off, frowned, scratched his head, and said, "We did, didn't we? Hours ago." After brief, intense contemplation, two men knew one thing, and did not know several other things. They did not really know they had romanced and rutted right on through their takeaway delivery. They didn't know that the neighbor and her best friend had rescued that takeaway and were right now laying on the floor in the dark, discussing the evening's events amid garlic burps. What John and Sherlock suddenly did know, as John shoved crabbed fingers into his hair again, was that Dr. Watson had head lice. Because lice do not care who makes the first dance move. It's all the same difference in the head lice tango. With a wicked smile, Sherlock said, "Come along, John. I'm going to wash your hair. I have a special shampoo." Author's note. This ends our journey through the world of head lice and sexual congress. Kindly gather all your possessions as you leave the carriage and thank you for your patronage. And do please watch out for the lice. like the honey badger, they just do not give a shit. This has been Hair Raising by Atlan Merrick.
Read by Laura McEwen. We thank you for listening. You can find the original text of this story on AO3 under Atlan Merrick. Music by Mika from the album The Boy Who Knew Too Much. Song title, Toy Boy.
I'm a wind-up toy in an up-down world. If you leave me all alone, I'll make a mess for sure. I've a heart of gold in the smallest size. Leave me in the dark, you'll never hear me cry. More than an illustration, points of articulation, come to life on a brass spring. Such a wonderful plaything. It's a cruel cross that I have to bear. If you come a little close, I'm going to pull your hair. More than just a toy in a patched blue suit. Hold me in your arms, I'm just a boy like you. But your mama thought there was something wrong. Didn't want you sleeping with a boy too long. It's a serious thing in a grown-up world. Maybe you'd be better with a Barbie girl. You knew that I adored you, but you left me in Georgia. Toys are not sentimental. How could I be for rental? She's the meanest hag that has ever been. Pulled out my insides with an old safety pin. I'm the sorest sight, now I feel like trash. Clothes are made of rags and they don't even match. So she dressed me up as the man she loved and threw me in a box when she had had enough. Now the light of day I no longer see. She stuck her voodoo pins where my eyes used to be. Accidentally tragic, victim of her black magic. Had a boy once who loved me. Now he's so afraid of me. On a long lost day when you're gray and old, he'll be there remembering your old toy boy. When your oldest son's wondering what to be, tell him the story of a boy like me.